Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 19th of August, as we make our connections with John Zogby, who's supposed to be in a special line, but we're having just a few difficulties with it. Let me introduce him. He is a longtime pollster, and he is the author of a very interesting new book, The Way Will Be, the Zogby Report on the Transformation of the American Dream. He has been called the maverick predictor who beat us all, according to the Washington Post, who in November of 1996, Zogby alone called that the presidential election with pinpoint accuracy. In the razor-thin 2000 elections, daily national tracking polls conducted by Zogby International in the last few weeks told a tightening of the race for president, while nearly all of the other polling firms projected an easy victory for Governor George W. Bush. He has done all kinds of polling. He's worked for Reuters News Agency, the largest news agency in the world. He polled for NBC News 2000 to 2004. His clients also include MSNBC, CNBC, The New York Post, Fox News, Knight Ridder Newspapers, Gannett News Service, Houston Chronicle, Miami Herald, Atlanta Journal-Constitution, The Albany Times Union, The Buffalo News, The St. Louis Post-Dispatch, Cincinnati Post, Cleveland Plain Dealer, The Toledo Blade, The Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, The Rochester Democrat, and The Syracuse Herald, and every daily newspaper in New York State, as well as television stations all over the country. You've seen him on television. He says one of his high points in life was his October 28th, 2004 appearance on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, and he was again a guest on January 9th of 2008. He also does other kinds of polling. We, of course, have talked to him extensively about political polling, and that will be the focus of our conversation because we're so close to the elections here. But he's also polled and researched and consulted for a wide spectrum of business, media, government, and political groups, including Coca-Cola, Microsoft, Philip Morris, St. Jude's Children's Hospital, Reuters America, the United States Census Bureau, and he teaches as well. He received the Distinguished Alumni Award in June of 2000 and was awarded honorary doctorate degrees from State University of New York and from a number of other places. So the book looks at a lot of interesting information. The book is, as you can tell, we're still trying to locate him, about four movements, and he calls meta-movements. And a lot of these are fueled by the 18 to 29-year-olds in this country, living with limits as consumers and citizens, embracing diversity of views and ways of life, looking inward to find spiritual comfort, and demanding authenticity from the media, from our leaders, and from leading institutions. He says this is all spearheaded by today's 18 to 29-year-olds, the first global generation. It's amazing how many of them have traveled abroad, and some of them, quite a few of them, more than one time by the time they're 24 years old. So he will be with us to talk about the latest book and all that's covered in it, and there's a great deal that's covered. I mean, how many pollsters do you know who poll people on which comedians they enjoy, and what does that tell us about our politics? So I think we have him. Okay, we have him on a different line than we thought we were. John Zogby is with us. We will get a lot of phone calls for him, so join us as soon as you'd like. Let us chat a few minutes, and then we'll be with you. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, 414-227-2050. And if you'd like to send an email, that's talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org for you to join the conversation. Hello, John. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's always a pleasure talking to you, Kathy.
Yeah, great pleasure to have you on. You know, the book looks at this 18 to 29-year-old who really, I don't think we've paid enough attention to, and I'm glad you have, that they're really changing. They're much more worldly. They've traveled more. They don't have narrow views about race in this country or about homosexuality in this country. They really are leading a way to a more open kind of global society, aren't they?
Yeah, they really are. You know, when I wrote the book, and of course that I finished it months ago, 42% of 18 to 29-year-olds had a live passport. Just in polling last month, that had climbed to the mid-50s.
Woo!
So it continues. And of course, there's no reason to believe that it's not going to continue with the younger age cohorts. But that's the point. The whole world is their playing field. Via travel, via the internet, global branding and global fashion, and it's extremely exciting. I mean, when we ask them what they consider themselves to be, there is likely that is 18 to 29 year olds with passports. They're as likely to say I'm a citizen of the planet Earth as to say I'm an American citizen. And to me, the most astounding thing that bowled me over is that 23% of this group said, I expect, not hope, but I expect to live and work in an exotic foreign capital at some point in my life. And that's just a sea change over previous 20-somethings, or for that matter, older age cohorts.
I bet you were one of the kids who said the same thing, though, right?
Well, I hoped to work in a foreign capital, but no, there's a difference this time around. They're actually doing it, and cost, whether it's the affluent or the not so affluent who are able to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning, find a wonderful airline deal, and then backpack.
Right,
they're finding a way to do it.
And then you've got the other thing going on. I was interested in your chapter on cars here, and Detroit so slow on the uptake that there is another segment of what's going on in America that's moving in the opposite direction.
Yeah, there really is, and just by way of disclaimer, most of this book was written before gas prices started to soar. But the point is, the broader point is that Americans are learning to live with limits. In some ways, it's been enforced upon them. The 27% who are living are working at a job that pays less, and for others, just a sense that material acquisition just doesn't define who I really am or enhance my life the way I hoped that it would. But in terms of whether it's practicality or spirituality, the age of the Hummer and the Silverado and the big, huge gas guzzler, this time I think is really over. Skeptics say, oh, we did this back in the 1970s, and then prices went down, and we binged again. But I look back at the 70s. I look back at the 80s when I first started polling in communities all over the country, and I remember people saying, you're asking people if they would consider recycling or stop smoking or not littering on the highway. You must be crazy. And in fact, all of those changes, those sacrifices in our behavior were made, and this is another change like that.
Right. Let's talk about the economy some. You talk about this investor class and have done polling with this. What is the investor class, John?
It's something that I started tracing back in 1997, where we asked people if they had a portfolio of some sort, any size, and we got an astoundingly large number. This was, we were well into the age of the 401k revolution. But I wanted to take it one step further and to ask them, do you consider yourself to be a member of the investor class? And of those who said yes, I just found, I thought, some very intriguing things. Generally speaking, the same demographic of who said, I'm a member of the investor class, was 10 to 12 points more likely to be conservative and vote Republican than the same demographic, maybe same age group, same gender, same racial minority. And so that this was a new identifier in our midst, and it is held up over the years. And so I'm able to see politically among the investor class where the Republicans are doing well, which means that they would be significantly ahead of Democrats among self-described investors, and when they fall down are not doing well among a group where they should. But this new investor class, we have to close our eyes and remember it's our friends and neighbors and colleagues. It's not Michael Douglas in Wall Street. These are people with very modest expectations who are not dreaming wild dreams about rags to riches, but instead are planning for a life as comfortable as they lead right now and to educate their kids.
Mm-hmm. And are there more of them as a result of tax policies in the last 8 years?
Interestingly, you know, because it is a psychological sort of thing as opposed to just a hard demographic, we got to a point in 2001, 2002 where the number dipped because there was a recession, and a fairly deep recession. The number then went sky high and way back up as the stock market boomed and the economy was, by most accounts, doing well. And right now, even with the dip in the stock market, we're still getting roughly 45 to 50% who say, I'm a member of the investor class. And that's about, where it was 10 years ago.
That's quite a few.
It is.
Mm-hmm. And what about those who don't invest at all or very, very little? Where are their political proclivities?
They tend to be Democrat and tend to be more liberal, although there certainly are a group who are not liberal. But of that group, you have a significant number of Hispanics and African Americans, low income people. The interesting thing, though, that I've learned is that lower income and lower education do not necessarily spell Democratic constituencies anymore, as they used to during the New Deal and Great Society coalitions. That, in effect, there's kind of been a flip here, and that lower to moderate income, the Walmart shoppers, for example, are those who may be just as likely inclined towards conservative values as they are towards wanting some kind of fiscal relief.
Well, that's interesting. Why is that?
Because we are not one-dimensional people. You know, James Carville is a good friend and a very smart man, but it's not the economy, stupid. We are not defined by whether the market's up or down or what's in our wallet at any given moment entirely. We are also motivated by a variety of other things that define us. For some, it's religion. For some, it's the values with which we grew up. Interestingly, you know, we talk about those who've moved to the suburbs, and, you know, we talk a lot about from the inner cities to the suburbs in one generation or two, people move from liberalism to conservatism. But what we also discover is that a number of those people, not all or most, but a number of those people were children, grandchildren of ethnic groups like Italians and Irish and Jews and Arab Americans and so on, who now are more comfortable and find more comforting conservative traditional values that they were taught because they're not struggling for the dollar anymore.
Mm-hmm. You talk about this, and I think this is such a good thing that so many people in this world, and I think the world is crying out for it, John, so many people in that 18 to 29, and maybe it goes beyond that, really do see themselves as living in a multicultural world.
They do, and a lot of it has to do with the fact that they are. And so the revolution in our midst is look at groups of young people. There was a time 15, 20 years ago and more where they were virtually, completely segregated. In schools, why are the black kids sitting by themselves? You know, look at the white kids over there in a corner by themselves. Mm-hmm. And there has been a significant change in that. We can tell from the questions that we ask, is there someone of another race who lives within one block? do you work for someone, a supervisor who is of another race? And I'm thinking in particularly when we ask this of white kids, do you have someone who you work for, or someone who is in a position of authority? Have you been to a party where there is someone who is African-American or Latino? And you just have to think back. I'm guessing that we're both old enough at least to have read about Central High in Little Rock, Arkansas.
Sure.
And to see the sea change and all of the mm-hmm. fighting and arguing over school busing and so on. But many of these kids go to integrated schools, and many of them now, because of worldwide television and worldwide internet, see a world that is Asian and African and Latin and Arab, and for them, it's just not a big deal. This is our world.
Mm-hmm. And can you find? I guess I've always thought that there's a great divide, or maybe I'm too Milwaukee-centered here, that there is a great divide between those who live in urban areas and those who live in suburban areas. And I'm wondering if you've looked at that. There is not as much diversity, at least in this area, between suburban and urban. It's incredibly segregated.
It is. It remains incredibly segregated, although, you know, the big story is the sheer growth in numbers of Hispanics, the growth as well in young African Americans and Asians, a huge growth, and then in the next generation, the increased interrelationship and intermarriage. You know, the report that was out last week from the census, the majority minority nation, but in reality, let's step back from that. And remember that between now and then, 34 years, there's going to be a lot of intermarriage. We're going to be more and more beige. And so questions of integration, of segregation, I think will still be part of us. I think that African Americans in particular will still feel the victimization of race and racial discrimination, but that we are heading towards an amalgamation, as we already have. I mean, many things were said about Italians: no Irish need apply, and so on. It's not a perfect world, and I'm not describing a perfect world, but I needed to step back and take a look and see, are we making progress? And I think I found that we are.
Yeah. I had this extraordinary experience at Irish Fest. We have this big Irish music festival every year, and it was a pretty white event, and everybody looked pretty Irish. And I was sitting there trying to find my son, and this kid who could have been probably 21 or 22 years old looked at me and started this conversation and said, there are a lot of white people down here. I don't see too many black people here. And I wondered, where the heck is this guy going with this? And next out of his mouth, he said, well, that's really a good thing because they bring down the property values. And my mouth just dropped. And I said, I live in a neighborhood where there are a lot of African Americans, and I love it. I think it's wonderfully diverse and terrific. And he didn't know how to respond to me. But what was as striking about what he said was that I just haven't heard that being said, you know, since some of my grandparents would say it how many years ago, 50 or 60 years ago.
Oh, it's still out there.
Yeah.
And you know, and of course we feel that it's out there in this presidential election.
Right.
You know, one of the interesting things, and perhaps downsides, is that this, you know, we talk about the Bradley effect, you know, that the mm-hmm. Tom Bradley didn't do as well as the polls showed because people were giving socially acceptable answers. Well, we saw in reverse of that Harold Ford, the African-American Senate candidate in Tennessee, actually got more votes than pre-election polls. And then we saw during the primaries voters actually saying, race is important to me, and I'm not going to vote for Obama because he's African-American. Now, from my vantage point as as a pollster, I say, oh, we can get the truth this time around. From my vantage point as an American and as a human being, I say, well, I wish that handful of people would go back in the closet and shut up. But bottom line is, race is still out there, but it's nowhere near a majority. It's more and more being pushed away, and I think in this new generation of globals, all of the infrastructure of integration and assimilation and so on has been built, and we have moved forward.
So you think the talking heads are making too much of this issue this go-around, John?
Oh, I do.
You do?
Oh, I absolutely do. Mm-hmm. Now, to be fair, taking some of those core states in the Mid-Atlantic and Old Northwest, North Central, where, you saw 15-20% who say race is very important. And ultimately, it's not a big number. I mean, it means on the flip side that there is 80%+ who are saying it doesn't matter. That's huge progress. By the same token, 15-20% who say that race does matter can loom very, very large in a tight election. But I guess the point of my book is there are so many books that have been written that describe what is wrong and why it's wrong.
Right.
And I saw some of these numbers jump out at me, and without trying to be Pollyannish in any way, something's going on here, and it seems to be moving in a positive direction.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take phone calls. John Zogby is our guest this hour, and he is the author of the just-released book, The Way Will Be, The Zogby Report on the Transformation of the American Dream. Our phone number lines are open, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. He says, this book is about the current state of America, the likelihoods of the close-in future, and the movement of our underlying social geology. Put it another way, this book explores who we are, what's changing, and the way we'll be. All right, to your phone calls in a moment. And what else did I want to say? Did I give the number? Oh, I do this so much. 800-486-8655, 414-227-2050 in Milwaukee. Email is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for John Zogby. Bear with us as we try this modern technology, which isn't working, so we have him back on the phone. So don't worry, one of these days we'll move into the modern world. We're trying. John Zogby is our guest, and we're having just a wide-ranging conversation, and a good one, about the ways that we are changing this country, and really for the better. His book is The Way Will Be, The Zogby Report on the American Dream. It has just been published by Random House, and we start our calls with Randy. Hi, Randy.
Yes, hi. Mr. Zogby, I come to you with respect from somebody else that I respect a lot, and that's Bill Press.
Oh.
He cites you often. I'm not sure if you're aware of that.
I have heard that, and Bill's a good guy and good friend.
Well, there's a lot of reasons why those things seem to run together. But because of that, when I heard you were going to be on, I wrote Bill at the beginning of this election cycle. I wrote him a memo outlining something that I have noticed over the years. I'm 56 now, and I've seen these elections through the Midwest here, there's a demographic that I have seen, and I want you to react to this, and if you believe this is valid. There's about 20 states where the far northern German, Dutch, Frisian Dutch type European emigrated to, and their families and the roots of their families that tend to not be the Catholic Germans, they tended to be the Protestant, more quiet Europeans, but they're very, very swingable. Now, they have been mistaken, I think, as the Reagan Democrats, but they were more like the Truman Democrats. They were the group that Truman said, I'm getting 50,000 of these people at milking time. As you trace elections through, they are up for grabs in every election. In Pennsylvania, they're Democrats. In Wisconsin, they tend to be Republicans. In central Illinois, they're Democrats. What I believe is this election is a lot closer than it appears based on sort of that group that's right in that swing. First of all, I want to know, is that correct? Am I seeing that group correct? And if so, those issues that they have, those sort of issues where they suspect government, but they're also very... they're the group that brought a lot of Jewish people out with their Protestant churches, out of Germany ahead of Hitler. They're very fair-minded, and they're very justice-oriented, but they're also skeptical of government. What I wonder is, who understands that group? Am I seeing that correctly? And also, am I not correct? This election is a lot closer than it appears.
Well, very interesting point, and I can't claim to know the demographics of voting of this group alone, but I certainly do have impressions, and I think by and large your impressions are right. Number one, this is a very close and competitive election, and I believe to a great degree it's Barack Obama's election to lose. I think this election will stay very competitive and very, very close right to the very end. And I think its model is the 1980 election, where it was very close between Ronald Reagan and Jimmy Carter. And then the dam burst. Once Americans decided, they had already decided they didn't like Jimmy Carter, but, you know, who is this old man? Once Reagan was able to make a transformation to being a kinder, gentler old man, as opposed to, you know, a radical ideologue with his finger on the trigger, they decided that it was comforting and gave him a landslide. And I think that's the potential here. If Americans want change, but they have questions about Barack Obama and his lack of his experience, his youth, and whether or not his American story is their American story. If he is able to credibly persuade people that he is that agent for change and has the capabilities to implement it, there'll be a landslide in his favor. On the other side, if Barack Obama cannot make that case, then there are a lot of Americans, and including this group that you talk about, who are very comfortable with John McCain, particularly if John McCain is not the radical right John McCain, but is the John McCain that so many people fell in love with in 2000, the maverick, independent, and so on. If Obama cannot make the case, then I think you can very well see a landslide for John McCain. I just don't think you're going to see a very close election. Here's how I sum it up in two sentences. If Barack Obama can be Jack Kennedy, with vision, the torch being passed to a new generation, that experience is clean and meaningful, he can win this. If John McCain is Harry Truman, give him hell, anti-Washington, anti-government, something is wrong, I'm the guy to come in and clean it up. Interestingly, ideology notwithstanding, I think you have two very interesting and good candidates here.
Mm-hmm. So tell me, what do you think? Are they living up to that? Is John McCain the maverick? Is Barack Obama the new Kennedy or not?
They both have the potential to do that, and I suspect we're going to find out during their convention speeches. I think as far as our lifetime is concerned, these are probably the two most important convention speeches in that period. Importantly, we have hints of Barack Obama. There's a lot of morphing into Jack Kennedy, but he's also been off message and on the defensive. However, we will see which direction he decides to define himself and how he determines he can neutralize a number of those shortcomings. He has to appeal to liberals, but at the same time, this election is going to be one in the middle. Can he go in the middle, as he did prior to his trip, without being accused of flip-flopping,
right,
or among younger voters in particular, being accused of oh, we thought you were different, but
right,
you're just another political.
Right. And what polling have you done among those voters? Because they have turned out in huge numbers, along with African Americans, to support his campaign. Is he losing them?
Interestingly, he is losing support among them. We had shown all year that among 18 to 29-year-olds in total, that that Barack Obama was getting upwards of 65% of their support to whichever Republican, and then ultimately John McCain, you know, in the 20s. But in the two most recent polls that we've taken, it's 52 to 38, 39, which is not enough of a margin for Barack Obama to win this. He's going to have to regenerate the enthusiasm level among young people. And then number two, he's also got to turn them out in record numbers.
Right. Thanks very much, Randy, for the call. Let's go to Scott from La Crosse. Hi, Scott.
Hi, good morning, Kathleen, and Mr. Zogby. I admire your work.
Thank you.
I would like to know whether you have done any polling or know of any polling that has been done on what I have heard some people refer to as the redemptive effect of an Obama presidency or an Obama win in November. In other words, the idea that this country, for all of its erratic and awful behavior at times, would have gone in one generation from an era where the black population in the country couldn't even eat in lunchrooms to having a black presidential candidate. And I guess why I have thought of this is I've heard some relatively conservative people like David Brooks having this sort of admiring tone. And it's not just about Obama, but it's about what Obama could mean in terms of what we could say about ourselves and whether that might make people be more accepting. And if not willing to even to vote for the guy necessarily, if the guy wins, to say, you know, good for us.
Very interesting question. The short answer is no. I have not done specific polling on that. You've given me an idea. My hunch tells me that perhaps no net gain. Who are most inclined to feel this sense of redemption for the United States of America? Probably those folks in all those blue areas throughout the United States that voted for Al Gore and voted for John Kerry. Yes, there are indeed conservatives who will vote for Barack Obama, I think, for a myriad of reasons, including some who will vote, you know, as you suggest. But by and large, I think the net gain comes from those who have had it with the Republican brand, and that Barack Obama is their, you know, is their opposite choice, as opposed to, you know, necessarily a pro-Obama stance. But in all honesty, I have not polled on that specific question.
But he might. Thanks to you, Scott.
Thank you both.
All right. Thanks very much for your call. Give us a quick guide. I know part of the book is a quick guide to reading polls.
Mm-hmm. For starters, you know, look at when the poll was done. If you get a presidential result that says, and the poll was taken between June 25th and August 14th, you can dismiss that poll, Kathleen, because a lot happened between those dates. So dates are important. Sample size is important. A nationwide sample should be around 1,000 likely voters. That's respectable. A margin of sampling error plus or minus 3. Look and see how the questions were asked. Were they one-sided? Were they loaded? Was there not enough information given? You know, when I poll on matters of policy, it's one thing to say, do you support oil drilling or not? Do you agree or disagree? Offshore, I should say. On the other hand, a better question is, supporters of oil drilling offshore say this, 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 and this. Opponents, on the other hand, make this case. And then you tie the question of oil drilling to some values on either side, core values that people hold. You get a truer response.
Hmm. Let's go to Paul from La Crosse. Hi, Paul.
Good morning. Yeah, what I'm hearing, though, is the same kind of analysis I hear every night on the Situation Room and Hardball and all the rest of them. And there's so many things it doesn't take into consideration. The biggest one is that when you go out and take your polls, where do you get your who do you poll? You generally go off of existing polling lists, and those are way out of date. Some of them probably a year old. Don't take into effect all the people that were registered for the primaries, and they really don't look at all the people that were registered in the summer. And Kathleen, you know, in Wisconsin, all the clerks are saying how many people have registered. It's a record.
Mm-hmm.
Almost all of them are Obama. And those people are not being counted in the polls. The other thing, in New York, I want to say her name was Rita Hauser or something like that, but she worked for the first Bush administration, and Republicans for Obama. And I mean, these are high powered people in the Republican Party who had, you know, staff positions and are saying John McCain's the wrong guy for president. Those guys are going to have an effect. Jim Leach in Iowa, not known outside the state, but he's respected in Iowa. He's come out for Obama. Arne Carlson in Minnesota would love to come out for Obama, but he hasn't yet. There's all these Republicans out there who are saying, we know John McCain. He's not a president. We can't trust him to be president, and they are going over to Obama. I think all these things taken into consideration, the loss of support among mainline Republicans, the number of people who are being added to the polls, and the voter turnout drive that's going to take place this fall, you know, it's very good. You got to look at one more thing, small thing.
Sure.
His numbers in the Electoral College haven't changed.
Mm.
He still has the majority. John McCain can take all the toss-up states, and he would still lose. So there has been no movement. And in the last, 2 months, he's been out of the country for 9 days, went on vacation for a week, and John McCain hasn't been able to make a move. No, the way the campaign is shaking out right now, Obama wins. It's just how big he wins.
John.
Wow. Okay, number one, you should know that I don't use lists. We generate our phone numbers at random, and so I don't use voter registration lists. I've had arguments with political consultants for years, and I'm winning. I mean, essentially, every household in the U.S. has the same chance of any other household of being called. And let me remind the caller, you should be home so that we can get you. Because that's an important consideration, and I'm kidding. the other thing is, no, there has been movement, and it's not good for, you know, there's a clustering that takes place, Kathleen. We hang around with people that we tend to agree with. In fact, many cases now, a new book that's out suggesting we choose to live in areas where we're likely to find people with whom we agree, but what we then find out when we take these samplings nationwide is that our world and our country and our community is larger than the barbershop and larger than the supermarket and larger than the hairdresser or the cab driver. That in reality, there is no question about the fact that Barack Obama's numbers have gone down. That's where all the polls indicate. I've got a poll coming out tomorrow actually suggesting that John McCain has made some gains and that Barack Obama has lost ground.
Hmm. Thanks very much for the call. Are you going to do the World of Oz question this go around, John?
I'm trying to think of something similar to that. You know, it didn't work out very well in 2004 for reasons that I discovered that I wish I had discovered before the election instead of after the election. But count on the fact that we'll come up with something. That is metaphoric.
Good. I like those. You must like putting those together,
too. I love it.
I'm sure. John Zogby is our guest. His new book is The Way Will Be, The Zogby Report on the Transformation of the American Dream, just published by Random House. We have a couple lines open if you'd like to join the conversation, and email and that's talk@WPR.org. Our telephone number is 800-486-8655, or in Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls now for John Zogby, and we go to John from Antigo. Hi, John.
Good morning.
Hi.
My impression, being 7 decades into this process, is that for decades, candidates have spent some time playing to their base, but then they tend to run from the center so that they can then govern from the fringe. And I'm wondering if your guest said a landslide for McCain under some circumstances, if he does that, he's a goner, but if he runs as a maverick, he may have a landslide. Whereas if Obama does exactly that, runs from the center so that he can govern from the fringe, he will have a landslide of his own. And did I get that right? Is that what you mean?
Well, I think to some degree, except for the governing from the fringe, this is complex. We had a very rare model with George W. Bush, who ran as a compassionate conservative but seldom showed himself to be one. He was a neoconservative for 8 years in office, foreign policy and domestic. And essentially what George Bush did was squandered a lot of support that he may have had from the center and even from opposition, and then ultimately squandered some of his own conservative support. I think the message here, this election, is that this is a 1932 moment. This is a 1980 moment. Americans have made up their minds about a very unpopular incumbent, and so in this case, an incumbent party. And now what they're doing is looking to see, does the opposition really represent change? That's the first part. If Obama can do that, he wins, and if he can't do that, McCain wins. No matter who wins, the American people have very high expectations this time. That's not only what they're telling us, but that's what they're showing us in voter turnout. I think we're going to get a record voter turnout in this election, and what that means is, like 32 and like 80, you're going to see a first 100 days where a candidate comes out of the chute with an aggressive program. Now, what will that program be in details? I don't know, but quite frankly, Franklin Roosevelt did not have a New Deal at this point.
Really?
In 1932. All he said to the American people is, I'm not sure what we're going to do. What I know is that we have to try something. And that's a direct quote.
Huh.
And so, interestingly, whoever the next president is will have his feet to the fire, as in few moments. This will be a major period of reform a year from now.
Interesting. You know, it's hard to believe that people haven't been tuned in on a daily basis, thinking at least 4 hours a day about the election of this year, as we have, John. But a lot of people haven't. And I'm wondering, when do your polls show that people actually pay very close attention to this? Are they not doing that right now?
You know, generally speaking, we have about 10% who are purely undecided for a variety of reasons. Either they like both guys or dislike both guys, or they really aren't paying any attention at all. And then you do have soft support that can swing. But, you know, 10 to 15% are not paying attention at all right now. And before we castigate them, let's remember what they're doing. You know, they're working double shifts.
Sure.
They're putting food on the table, getting the kids off to school, worried about a forfeiture, or, you know, just very, very busy to sit down and to pay attention, not to talking heads on television, but with all respect to yelling heads on cable television.
Right.
Do you really want to spend your evenings doing that? You know, when you have so little time.
Right.
And so when do they start paying attention? You'll start to see the numbers dwindle a little bit after the conventions. But this year, I think we may be going into the final week with 10% undecided.
My. Thanks, John, so much for your call. Tim is next from Green Bay. Hi, Tim.
Hi.
Hi.
I remember my political science classes, and there were studies done where people voted as their parents voted, and I'm wondering if you have any data on what percentage of people vote with parents these days.
You know, that's a really interesting question. The studies used to show that 80% is where is how we that 80% of us took our political identification from our parents, and then of that 80%, the overwhelming majority voted in a way that revealed our political identification. There's a lot of fluidity out there now. More and more people calling themselves independents or moderates. Not a breakdown of the party structure, but the political parties are not the local structural animals that they used to be, because so many people get their political ideas from television, from the media. They get them as well from the internet, and they get them obviously then from their friends. And so clearly that has broken down.
And thanks for your call, Bob from Glenwood City. Hi, Bob.
Good morning. Two quick questions. Based on historical or looking back, does the vice presidential pick actually influence the polls or the results of an election? Obviously, we get a little spike in the news and everyone gets excited, but does it really impact anybody's decision?
The short answer is not really. 1 point at most historically. Now, when you're talking about the last two elections that were razor thin, 1 point is very, very large. But no, in the final analysis, you're absolutely right. It's the first 72 hours of the announcement, and the key is do no harm in those 72 hours. And then lastly, at the very end, very few vote for the vice president.
Hmm.
And then my second question is, with more and more people dropping their landlines, living on their cell phones alone, how does that affect your polling pool?
It's significant. We are still able to get a good representation. I use landline only, although, as you know, your landline today, your telephone number is portable, and so we may call it and get you on your cell phone. But we're heading towards a crisis. We at Zogby International are not going to be polling cell phones because, quite frankly, a typical poll is 30, 40, 50, 60 questions, and we would move from simply annoying people to an all-out invasion. You don't want to be answering 50 questions on the phone. That's why we've made the segue into a very good online or interactive poll that has a real element of science to us. So I think what's happening is the telephone is used and is still accurate, but it's on the decline. Meanwhile, the online interactive poll is about 90% effective. We're sort of betwixt and between right now.
Mm. Thanks for the call. One more phone call, probably getting short on time. Joe from Dubuque. Hi, Joe.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. You have a very good show. I have so many questions here, I don't know where to start. But the one thing is, like, if I were to hire your guest and I want to do a poll on my new product, whatever, and I give him X amount of dollars, I'm so skeptical anymore of politicians and TV. I think how is the poll going to come out, and like who's he working for, and all those factors. There's so many factors. I feel like now they're already talking. Obama's got the nomination. Hey, I hope they have such a surprise next week in Denver that they just don't know how to handle it because they've just shoved this down our throat. I think it's just because he's got a neat name. It's like a rock star. you know, what's the guy ever done, you know? You can tell where I'm going to vote, but and I've been a registered Democrat, but I sure as hell won't vote that way this time. But I got a million questions here.
All right, well, we only have 15 seconds, John.
That's the first time I've ever heard that Barack Obama's name is a real advantage going into this election, so I thank you for that.
John, thank you so much for being with us. I hope that we'll be able to connect again during the convention or certainly during the time that we vote.
Absolutely. Love doing your show, Kathy.
Thanks, John. We love to have you on. John Zogby is our guest, and the book is The Way Will Be, The Zogby Report on the Transformation of the American Dream. It has just been published by Random House. And there's so much that we didn't get to, actually, in the book. We forgot, well, we just didn't have time to talk about our spiritual lives, embracing diversity of views and ways of life, looking inward to find spiritual comfort, and demanding authenticity from the media. The book is very, very interesting. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, to John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee, and thanks, everybody, for all of your calls and for listening. We'll be with you again tomorrow at 9 o'clock, so be with us. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.